Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain has the day off today. As the tensions on the Korean Peninsula continue to grab headlines, it might seem as if North Korea and South Korea have always been two separate entities, one closed to the world and one open. This isn't true, of course. The split happened just after World War II, and Korean history itself stretches back thousands of years. Well, Min Jin Lee's novel Pachinko is set at least in part in the Korea of a century ago when the peninsula was whole but under the thumb of Japanese occupation. It's a richly layered story of several generations of one Korean family who, through circumstance and hardship, end up living in Japan, part and yet not part of a society which at the time rejected Koreans as less than. Pachinko was a National Book Award finalist in 2017, and this is the second in a trilogy about the Korean experience. Min Jin Lee joins us in studio to tell us about the novel, the writing of it, the research, and much more. And welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
So before we get going, here's the number to call. In case folks who are listening in might want to jump into the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So I loved this novel.
Thank you.
It's not necessarily a book about happy endings or storylines that tie up neatly, but it's really an immersion into this story of generations of a family, an immersion into Korean culture of 30 to 100 years ago, especially as it relates to Japan. And it's something I'm not sure many of us in this country are familiar with.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It wasn't familiar to me. I was a history major in college, and I learned about it when I was 19 when I attended a lecture. But overall, I have met a lot of readers at this point. I've been on tour for a while, and everybody always says, I did not know. And I think, well, how could you know? It's not part of the curriculum. I mean, Asian history really isn't taught. When we think about World War II, even today, very educated people think about the European theater of war,
sure,
not about Asia. But of course, Japan and Germany were allies.
Yeah. So why don't we begin with a brief sketch of some of the main characters and the early story. And forgive some of my pronunciations. I'm sure they're going to be off. Sunja is front and center. And her mother is Yang Jin, and Hoonie is her father.
Your Korean is very good, Mary.
Oh, I studied hard. But so they're this little family that lives in a small fishing village in Korea. And let's start talking about the parents. Hoonie, he's born with a cleft palate, a twisted foot, mm-hmm. not considered to be marriage material.
That's right.
He accepts this.
Of course.
Which I guess, well, in our society, we wouldn't necessarily accept this. But back right. in that time, in that culture, he accepts this. I was kind of surprised at the acceptance. But still, I'd like to read a passage from the book in which a matchmaker has her eye on Hoonie for a possible marriage. So take it away.
Sure. The girl was from the other side of the island, beyond the dense woods. Her father, a tenant farmer, was one of the many who'd lost his lease as a result of the colonial government's recent land surveys. The widower, cursed with four girls and no sons, had nothing to eat except for what was gathered from the woods, fish she couldn't sell, or the occasional charity from equally impoverished neighbors. The decent father had begged the matchmaker to find grooms for his unmarried daughters, since it was better for virgins to marry anyone than to scrounge for food when men and women were hungry, and virtue was expensive. The girl Youngjin was the last of the four girls and the easiest to unload because she was too young to complain and she had the least to eat. Youngjin was 15 and mild and tender as a newborn calf, the matchmaker said. No dowry, of course, and surely the father could not expect much in the way of gifts. Perhaps a few laying hens, cotton cloth for Youngjin's sisters, 6 or 7 millet sacks to get them through the winter. And hearing no protest at the tally of gifts, the matchmaker grew bolder. Maybe a goat or a small pig. The family has so little, and the bride prices have come down so much. The girl wouldn't need any jewelry. The matchmaker laughed a little. With a flick of her wrist, Huni's mother showered the radish with salt. The matchmaker could not have known how hard Huni's mother was concentrating and thinking about what the woman wanted. The mother would have given up anything to raise the bride price demanded. Huni's mother found herself surprised at the imaginings and hopes rising within her breast, but her face remained collected and private. Nevertheless, the matchmaker was no fool. "Oh, what I wouldn't give to have a grandson of my own one day," the matchmaker said, making her closing gambit while peering hard at the boarding housekeeper's creased brown face. "I have a granddaughter, but no grandsons, and the girl cries too much." The matchmaker continued, "I remember holding my first son when he was a baby. Oh, how happy I was. He was as white as a basket of fresh rice cakes on New Year's, soft and juicy as warm dough, tasty enough to take a bite. Well, now he's just a big dolt," feeling the need to add a complaint to her bragging. Huni's mother smiled, finally, because the image was almost too vivid for her. What old woman didn't yearn to hold her grandson when such a thought had been inconceivable before this visit?
The bride and groom do meet on their wedding day, and they seem to enjoy a beautiful, if short, married life. The characters in this story endure a daily hardship that I'm going to venture to say many in our first world country, with all its conveniences, can't really imagine. I mean, Huni dies when Sunja is 13. His widow and daughter, as you write in the story, are inconsolable at the burial. But the next morning, Youngjin rises from her pallet and goes to work. There are no support groups. There's no therapy. There's no day off. There's nothing. Tell us about that.
Well, that's the thing that I really learned from interviewing so many working class people when I was in Asia, not just in Japan, but also in South Korea, is just how matter of fact they are about what they have to do to survive. And their attitude is, what are you so upset about? You just have to do it. And it's not that depression doesn't exist or mental health issues don't exist. It's just that they're not tolerated. And I think consequently, you have other problems. Symptoms do pop up elsewhere, like alcoholism or gambling or excessive prostitution. There's a lot of things that do happen. However, there is a kind of overwhelming understanding. Just do it. Just do it, and you have to get on with it.
Yeah. And in one of the interviews that I read regarding your work, you had found, if I'm correct, that at times you were more upset about their suffering than they seemed to be when they were telling you these stories.
I'm a giant crybaby. No, this is really true. I get upset about a lot of things. Like, I read the newspaper and I'm just bawling because I'm like, how could this be? This is so horrible.
I get that.
And then they looked at me and said, you know, these things happen. So my son could not get a job after graduating from this incredible university. He has to get something else. He should be lucky to be alive. I mean, they're really so matter of fact and hard that I just felt like,
okay. And accepting. It's accepting.
Just accepting, resolute, accepting. Yeah. And they almost chided me a little bit, kind of like, man, you really just have to toughen up a bit. I think they felt sorry for me.
So continuing a little bit more with the story, Sunja, the daughter, she's, what, 15 or 16, and she's out and about at a market, and she meets a fish broker. Mm-hmm. Ko Hansu?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And take it away. Tell us as much as you'd like, just so, again, so we can set the scene without revealing the entire story arc.
So he's called Ko Hansu because in Korea, as well as in the United States, when you call somebody their name, the last name comes first. So his name is actually Hansu. So my name wouldn't be Minjin Lee, it'd be Lee Minjin. That's the way it would be accepted. So Ko Hansu is a very sexy character. I found him in an old photograph when I was doing a lot of research, and there was a very prominent fish broker, and he was literally dressed head to toe in white, kind of like Mark Twain, but with white patent leather shoes for the period. And I thought, oh, look at that. He's a fish broker. And you could tell he was so important because he was surrounded by all these other people, but he kind of gleamed in the black and white photograph. And I thought, that's my guy. I'm going to write about him. And then, of course, I ended up interviewing all these Ko Hansu types. They were very alpha male, very powerful, very... You can almost feel the heat kind of rising from their bodies because they're so important and they can get stuff done. And I found them really alluring. I mean, my advice always is, because I have met a lot of readers who really kind of fall for him, and I go, you know, it's important that you recognize you're attracted to a person like this. However, do not sleep with him. Do not bear his child.
And unfortunately, the character Sun Jia...
Of course.
You know, she's just a girl.
She just falls for it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But he falls for her, too.
He falls for her deeply.
Yeah.
He falls for her deeply because one of the things that I learned from interviewing anthropologists, believe it or not, is the role of the first wife and the person who bears a child for you, especially a male child, holds a very special place in your memory and in your heart. So... he gets really attached to her as well as to the child that she bears for him. And it becomes a lifelong, not necessarily a romance, but this attachment.
A fascinating relationship.
Yeah.
And yet, so back up just a little bit. Sun Jia becomes pregnant. She's just a girl and she's not married.
No.
And this is a crisis because along comes, is it Isaac Beck?
Yes.
Okay. A Christian missionary who literally saves her, because if this character hadn't come along, what happens to a young, unmarried girl like Sun Jia? Because even though the character Hansu wants to keep her, he can't marry her.
Well, he won't marry
her. Okay.
Right.
So what would have happened to somebody like her?
Well, I did a lot of research for this, and I interviewed a bunch of historians. And they said, you know, if you're a working class girl at that point in life, it would have been scandalous. And the contamination of the reputation would have kind of basically been imputed also to her mother, who's just a boarding house operator. It's not like she owned this house. She was renting a place, and then she was taking in tenants. And then from the income that she earned from her tenants, she was paying her landlord. So if she lost her business, then everybody would have starved. So it was a horrific thing, and I think everybody was really worried about it. And of course, Isaac comes, he's really ill, and they nurse him back to health, and he decides to make this incredibly grand gesture because he's thinking, I'm going to die anyway. And if I die anyway, why don't I live a big life? And why don't I do a really great thing? And he was inspired by a really obscure book in the Bible called Hosea, which is a very short Bible book. And in it, God makes Hosea marry the town harlot because God wants Hosea to feel what it's like to love, to feel the way he feels because he feels that people don't love him.
Yeah.
So he decides, I'm going to be like Hosea, and he does this crazy thing. And of course, the other minister's like, don't take it so literally. That's not what they mean.
Well, they marry anyway, and then they go to Japan. And we'll pick up the story from there. I'm talking to Minjin Lee, author of the National Book Award finalist Pachinko, this hour. We're talking to her. If you'd like to jump in, 888-477-9499 is the number to call. And you're listening to Radio Times. Stay with us. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty Moskowain is off today. And we are interviewing Minjin Lee, who is author of Pachinko, which was a National Book Award finalist in 2017. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we're going to go along with this young family at the turn of the 20th century who's emigrating from Korea to Japan in just a moment. But first, let's get to this question from Joan, who asks you, Minjin, do you have a personal connection to this story?
Oh, absolutely. I heard about the Korean-Japanese people when I was in college, and I was 19 years old. And an American missionary came to talk at the university, and I went to the talk because a friend of mine asked me to, and nobody wanted to go. So there were two of us, two undergraduates, the speaker and the organizer, so I really couldn't leave. And he told, you know, us a story about the history of Koreans in Japan. I knew nothing about it. And then finally, he talked about this little boy who had climbed up to his apartment building. He was only 13 years old, and he was Korean-Japanese, and he jumped to his death. And his parents looked through his things, and they found his middle school yearbook because the boy had just graduated. And they're really just traumatized. And in the yearbook, they found that his Japanese classmates had written, "Go back to where you belong. We hate you. You smell like kimchi." And they wrote the words, "Die, die, die." Mm. And that story just kind of burned into my brain. I really couldn't get rid of it. And I didn't know what to make of it because I had come to America in 1976 when I was seven. And I was not treated that way. And I really,
from Seoul, right?
Yes, exactly, from Seoul. And this boy was just being hated ethnically because he was Korean. There was really no other reason to hate this child. And it was really hard for me to understand how children can hate this much. Because I had not been hated. And I was a very awkward kid. I had a lot of speech issues. My sisters were fine with the fact that we came to this country. I had great trouble acclimating. And yet, I was not bullied. I didn't have this experience. My teachers in my very lower middle class public school were very good to me. Librarians really took me on and kind of gave me all these things. So I think I felt outraged by the way this boy was treated. And I think there's a part of me, and I think this is what writers do, we always want to fix things. And I think that for me, and what ended up happening was this book has bullying as maybe like 2% of the book. Yeah. But I stayed with this project because I felt personally, I was really upset by it.
This story does end up in some form in Pachinko.
It does.
And there is no happy ending to this particular storyline. You don't feel a need in this story arc to tie things up neatly with a bow, to have people riding off in the sunset. Why is that?
I think that this book is quite realistic because one of the things that I noticed when I wrote the book in an earlier version, so I wrote an entire book between 1996 to 2003, and I had to throw it away because it was
nine
really...
9 years. Was that nine? Something like that. 96 and... no, that'd be seven. Okay.
No, it's okay. My math is quite poor, so I was like, maybe it is nine.
As is mine.
Yeah. So in that manuscript, it was very accurate, but it's a very angry book. And I think it's because I was very angry. And then whereas this manuscript became much more about love and resilience, because one of the things that I really wanted to witness is that even though things are very unfair, people are very adaptive and smart. And they didn't respond in outrage the way I had or being emotionally upset. Their attitude is we're going to adapt and keep adapting and we're going to win sometimes. And I found that to be very inspiring. So I wanted to tell that story.
So back to the early storyline, this young family, Sunja, Isaac, they emigrate to Japan to meet up with Isaac's brother, Joseph. Mm-hmm. And these are all names from the Bible.
That's right.
Kind of the Korean take. Mm-hmm. Tell us about how Korean immigrants at the time were viewed in Japan at the time this story begins. So we're talking again at the early part of the 20th century.
Well, Japan was trying to expand at the turn of the century in very similar ways England was expanding around the world. So colonization was their way of trying to figure out how do we get more territory and power. Also, Japan, even today, doesn't have much arable land. It's a very hard place to grow food. So Korea became a kind of breadbasket. And whenever you colonize another country, you have to figure out, well, how do I justify this taking? So very often, Koreans were seen as lazy, unprincipled, disorganized, and they needed the organizational skills of Japan. So there was a lot of interesting rationalizations if you look at the wartime and the expansionist theories that somehow the greater prosperity of all of Asia would be benefited if Japan extended its reach. And they justified this also with China, Singapore, Taiwan. They just kept going, the Philippines. And that was interesting to me because it wasn't that different from the way European models used how they justified their taking.
Hmm. We have a call from Sue who says, "I love this book. What is the significance of the book title?"
Oh,
Pachinko.
So is Sue from my publisher? Because that's a good question.
She beat me to it, actually. I was going to ask you about that. I'd never heard of Pachinko before I read this book. What is Pachinko and what was the significance to the Koreans who emigrated to Japan?
Sure. So Pachinko is a $203 billion business today. That is twice the export revenues of the Japanese auto industry. Mm. And that's an important thing to remember because it's a cornerstone of the Japanese economy today. It's not like the way you and I think about leisure of going to Las Vegas. It's an adult gambling game. It's pinball, but it's vertical, so it's not horizontal where you kind of hit the slots. And adults play it. It's not for children. And you could lose your shirt very easily, just in about 10 minutes. Like, you can lose, you know, $1,000 in about 10 minutes if you wanted to, depending upon how you play it. Anyhow, so what's important is that it wasn't always this way. So when it first started at the turn of the century and it became very popular after the war, you had people carry these machines into festivals and fairs, like one machine, and then the children would play at that time, and then you would win a toy. And then gradually you started accumulating machines and you started to get shelter for the machines and they became parlors.
Yeah.
Right. The Koreans did not start this game, but they became part of it, especially after the game became considered low class and criminal. And once it became low class and criminal, Japanese were playing the game, but they didn't want to work in this field. And Koreans were recruited and they were working in it. So men essentially who were Korean, who even with an education, they couldn't get jobs legally because of the structural discrimination against them. Like, they couldn't become police officers or garbage sanitation workers. They couldn't become, let's say, elementary school teachers. They couldn't have aspirations, postal workers, that regular lower middle class people might have.
Sure.
And consequently, the men fell into pachinko and women went into the barbecue business, the yakiniku business, where they sold restaurants. And unfortunately, right now, the pachinko industry is still dominated by the Koreans in Japan because they've stayed in that business. There are a lot of Japanese who work in there as well. However, all the characteristics of pachinko that are negative are also imputed on the Korean people today and becomes vice versa.
And some of the negative characteristics, at least, you know, from what I took from this novel, was that at least some pachinko is associated with Yakuza.
That's right.
Which
That's
was
right,
the gang structure.
The organized crime.
Yeah.
Because pachinko did have a criminal element to it, especially before it was heavily regulated about 30 years ago. So today, I do not believe that there's a criminal element to it. Yeah. I've done the research. It's heavily taxed, heavily organized. The police are really involved in it today. However, 30 years ago, there was a lot of room for corruption because gambling even today is technically illegal. So there are all these ways that you kind of go around in order for you to win money in pachinko. So it used to be that you played pachinko and you won, let's say, a fluffy doll. And you go around the corner to a dark alley and you exchange the doll for money. And then the doll goes right back to the store.
Uh-huh.
So there was a kind of – but nowadays, you win, let's say, a little card with a chip of gold embedded into it. So the card itself has value. But, of course, why do you want this card with gold in it? So you go next door. Usually almost just a glass wall divides between the exchange, the cashier, and the actual parlor. You give the gold card, and the cashier just gives you cash. And it's very simple. That's it. Going back to the question, I believe it was Sue,
yeah,
who asked about what is the significance of this title. Pachinko is a rigged game, just like any gambling is rigged. The odds always favor the house. And one of the things that I wanted to argue is that life is like that for all of us. We are constantly participating in things in which we know our likelihood of success is almost minimal. I mean, at best, maybe you have a 50% shot, and yet we have to play. And that is what I really learned from meeting the Korean Japanese people, is that they play anyway. They don't give up. And I found that to be quite amazing.
Back to the novel for just a moment. So the character of Hansu, the fish broker, ends up becoming Yakuza. If he's not already,
he absolutely
meets
Yakuza.
Yeah,
yes.
Soon-ja. And the relationship between the two, they kind of parallel each other through the book. And he remains in her life, again, without giving too much away. He is the father of her son.
Yes.
She is the one person who can say no to him.
Yes.
And he's a dangerous man.
Yeah.
And for some reason, he does not strike back at her. He'd strike back at anybody else.
That's right.
With brutal consequence, but he does not strike her physically, mentally, emotionally. Why?
I think that she responds to him in a way that has such integrity, and he knows it. And she reminds him of home, because he comes from a very working class, very impoverished background, just the way she does. And something about her integrity and dignity checks him.
She gives him nothing.
She gives him nothing. Her attitude is like, you're not what I want.
Yeah,
you're not a good man, and I know you're not a good man. And I got duped, but I will not get duped again. And I found that to be really interesting.
Comment from Adelaide, your book is set in the 30s. Do you think this anti-Korean sentiment still resonates in Japan today?
Yes, I do.
In what way?
Absolutely. I think there's still a very clear social norm in Japan that says that foreigners can never be Japanese.
So it's not just Koreans, it's foreigners in
general.
No, all
foreigners. Mm. I mean, I've had white foreigners who become Japanese citizens who will never be considered Japanese. So for example,
Why is that?
Because Japan believes in a kind of racial purity as necessary for their national myth. And I don't fault Japan for it. It's just a different cultural value. Japan believes in racial purity. They also believe that the reason why Japan is a great country is because it's a middle-class country in which everybody has what they need. Everybody has two parents. Everybody has, you know, a certain kind of behavior. Consequently, a lot of Japanese who don't fit into that definition suffer enormously. So it's not just the Japanese who exclude the foreigners. It's actually the Japanese exclude those who are different. And I think there's a lot of resistance towards this idea, but there's an attachment to it as well. And I don't believe it'll change. If you are Chinese and you have been in Japan for five generations, if you are Korean, you're still going to be perceived as less than. And I've seen this, and I don't think there's a Japanese person who would disagree with me.
Yeah. So then this novel, this concept could it be perceived as anti-Japanese? And if this is the case, how do you feel about that perception?
I don't think this book is anti-Japanese. I think it's very reflective of what's the experience. Many Japanese have said this book has let the Japanese get off very easily, that I wasn't as hard as I could have been. And I didn't think I wanted to be as hard as I wanted as the history had reflected it, because the Korean Japanese themselves often defended the Japanese point of view.
Why is that?
Because they are culturally Japanese. They actually love the Japanese. So this is a
funny
thing.
But they're not quite.
Exactly. No, this is the irony of human beings, is that we still want to belong to the clubs that don't want us. So,
or the concept perhaps of just accepting things
sure.
for what they are.
Absolutely. And their attitudes, we don't belong anywhere else at this point. So we're going to stay here because they don't belong in Korea either.
Yeah. Oh, so they would not be able to go back.
At this point, it'll be really difficult. Yeah. I mean, they can.
It's so different, but they're kind of caught in between.
Right. And yeah. It's not like the South Koreans are holding out a welcome banner saying, come over. As a matter of fact, when they do come, when they do go visit South Korea has its own absurd ideas about their national myth. So they're not welcoming to foreigners either. So I don't think that I'm saying the Japanese have these ideas. So many nations have this idea that we need to have racial purity and to have the same kinds of people. Otherwise, we can't have peace.
Let's get to the phones. Carl in Chestnut Hill is live with us on Radio Times. Hi, Carl.
Hi. So actually, I called immediately after you talked about and then since then you mentioned.
Oh, I think you're dropping out, Carl. Why don't you try to call back and we'll try to get you on with a better line. All right. I did want to mention there's another word in the book for Korean Japanese, and that is Zainichi?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I read in The Atlantic, Minjin Lee, that you looked to the biblical story of Joseph.
Yes.
For inspiration. Mm-hmm. Give us a quick recap, just a very quick recap of the story, if you would, and how this fit into your shaping of Pachinko.
So the story of Joseph, it takes a number of chapters in the book of Genesis, which is such an incredibly cool book in the Bible. As a matter of fact, I think the book of Genesis could yield at least 100,000 different novels because there's so many things in it. But my favorite verse in Genesis is, and I'm paraphrasing here, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And what a crazy line. I mean, it's a crazy line because it basically argues that something terrible can happen to you. And somehow there's a reason and a design and a purpose that could yield something positive. Mm. And that idea troubles me and also delights me. It's both things. So what happens to Joseph is that he is the last child of Jacob, and his father just favors him. His brothers can't stand him, and they eventually sell him into slavery. And then when he gets sold into slavery, he gets to work for this really important guy, and then his wife tries to get him to sleep with her, and then he resists, and then later on he gets put into jail unfairly. he languishes in jail for a really long time, and later on he interprets some dreams that are important, and then he gets elevated to become the right-hand man of the Pharaoh, and he delivers the entire population of Egypt, and then he also ends up delivering all the Jews who are also starving. Mm. And later on, when his brothers come to him and say, I'm really, really sorry, you know, like, for having sold you into slavery, he delivers this great line, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And that was quite amazing to me.
You are quoted in The Atlantic as saying that kind of optimism or sense of divine purpose is hard to muster as a modern person.
Oh, absolutely. If someone sold me into slavery, I wouldn't be thinking 40 years down the line. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Some of your main characters are Christian. Many or some are not. Tell us about the concept of, I guess, the tension between the two. You know, I don't know that Sunja ever accepts her husband, Isaac, was Christian. Mm-hmm. And she kind of, sort of accepts perhaps the concept of a God maybe toward the end of the story. But there's this tension among characters, but they kind of live together and they move forward together, even as there's this religion that I guess is primarily Western religion has taken root in their country. Tell us about that.
So the role
in about 20 seconds before the break. Sorry about that.
No, Christianity becomes so important to Koreans in the history of modern Korea at the turn of the century until today even, because they became so politically active in terms of resistance.
Min Jin Lee is author of Pachinko. She is with us for the rest of the hour here on Radio Times. And again, the number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you as we continue our conversation. Keep it here. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And in studio with us is Min Jin Lee, the author of Pachinko. Just a little bit more about the book. You talked about earlier in the program, the story that you're talking about, the 13-year-old boy committed suicide. And that story does show up in a form in the book. And it's reflected in an experience that is experienced by a police officer, Haruki, who has to grapple with the tragedy of the suicide. This character is gay and closeted. Tell us about his place in the novel and in the time in which it's written.
One of the things that I learned about how Japan works then and now is that because of their attachment to this sort of myth of purity and homogeneity and how everybody has to be the same, is that those who are different are severely punished in the quality of their lives. So even today, it's not easy to be gay in Japan, and certainly it was not easy to be gay 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And this young man is in love with Moses. Of course, he cannot act on it because Moses is straight.
And Moses, or Mosasu, is the another son of Sunja.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Who's another central character. So Sunja has two sons, and Moses is his friends with Totoyama, Haruki. And I was really struck by the gay culture in Japan because there's a whole other kind of very private world in which they have to hide. And I thought that it was interesting to me that when the Korean Japanese that I interviewed talked sensitively and sympathetically towards the Japanese who had been kind to them. Very often, the ones who were kind to them were those who are also outside of their own culture. Mm-hmm. So you'll see characters in this book who suffer because, like, so if you're a mom and you have a child who's disabled, you're outside. If you are divorced, you're outside. If you're a child of divorce, you're outside. If you're gay, you're outside. If you're sick, you're outside. And all those characters are in this book, because they also form community and alliance with those who are different. And they, in this case, it's the Korean Japanese.
Have a note from Kate in Moorestown, New Jersey. She asks, do you make a plan ahead of time when writing characters? And are you ever surprised by where you take your characters?
I make lots and lots of plans on very cheap paper. And I throw away a lot of my plans. Those who are very surprised by this fact I'll share with you is that Sunja came the last. She was my last character.
Really?
Yes. So my first character was Solomon. So my entire
Solomon's
first,
actually her grandson.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I started completely back. I had no intentions of writing a historical novel because they're very difficult to do. I may never do this again because it took so much authority and confidence and research that in order for me to write something, I have to feel like I really know it backwards and forwards and vertically and horizontally. And then I forget most of it and then I just focus on what's important fictionally. But for me to get there, it took me, oh golly, 2 decades. And Sanja came dead last and then had to rewrite the whole thing all over again to accommodate her centrality.
Are you happy you did it that way?
I'm happy I did it, but golly, it was such a stupid way to work.
Well, you're at work on a third novel now.
I am.
Are you not?
And I am.
Is this different?
I hope so.
So Pachinko was really the second in a trilogy.
That's right.
The first was Free Food for Millionaires. Briefly, what is that one about?
Sure. So Free Food for Millionaires is about a young girl who's from Queens, New York, and she goes to a very fancy college, Princeton University, and then she graduates and she's got to figure out what to do with her life. It's about the trajectory of her decisions of what to do with her career. Her parents are working class. And one of the things that I really wanted to talk about is what does it mean to have these class aspirations for immigrants? And
she's an immigrant. Her family's from where?
From Korea.
Okay.
So my diaspora trilogy is about the Koreans. It's called The Koreans. And the first one is Free Food for Millionaires, Koreans in America. The second is Pachinko, Koreans in Japan. And the third one will be called American Hagwon. Hagwon is a tutoring center. It's a Korean word for a tutoring center. And it's about the role of education for all Koreans around the world. And then afterwards, I'm done, Mary. I'm done.
Really? We'll see.
We'll see.
So you were actually an attorney when you decided to make the decision to switch
yes.
to writing. How'd
yes.
that happen?
I was really sick. So
sick in what way?
I had a liver disease. Hmm. So I don't have it anymore. So I got a liver disease. Well, I was diagnosed with it when I was in high school when I gave blood. I used to be a chronic hepatitis B carrier. So I had this thing, and then when I was in university, I got really, really sick because I became symptomatic. Because when you are a carrier, you can be asymptomatic or symptomatic. And then when I was an attorney, I was working intensely, and I thought that I would get sick again. So I thought that I would quit and become a fiction writer because it's so easy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was really smart.
So 7 years with one novel, and then you have to rip it up and try again, right?
Yeah, that's really, such a dummy.
So, well, you've also said your wheelhouse is 19th century literature. I read mm-hmm. that in an interview that you did. How so, and why?
Well, I write only in omniscient narration. So I am writing
Which means?
That
you are the god creating your
That's
universe.
Right. Okay. I am the narrator and I know exactly what's happening to every single character and everything is in past tense. So you know that I know what's going to happen at the very end to everybody. And those are the kinds of novels that I love to read and those are the novels that I study in terms of trying to figure out how to write those kinds of novels. Very few of my contemporaries do that anymore. And I also try to write it in a modern American stylistic sentence. Because 19th century novels aren't really read widely anymore by modern people because the narrators could be very intrusive and very annoying and very show-offy. So you want to kind of walk away from the, and dear reader, I married him. So I didn't want that kind of narrator, but yeah. I did want to have this narrator who was very fair, almost like a journalist, because I work very much like a journalist and an academic in my research. So I thought, how can I have a narrator who's very fair and yet not in your face about how brilliant he is. So I really studied American stylists who are nonfiction writers that I really admire, kind of like Joan Didion, Annie Dillard, John McPhee, Tom Wolfe. Like I try to write those kinds of sentences, but then to have this 19th century episodic plot, heavily plot driven fiction. And that took me forever to figure out.
Pachinko, as we've mentioned, was a National Book Award finalist last year. So when you heard about that, what was your reaction?
I was so surprised. I can't tell you how surprising this book has been, the trajectory, because when I was working on it, I figured I have chosen the dumbest topic, and I cannot believe I spent most of my life doing
really?
This.
Really? The dumbest topic? I find it fascinating.
Oh, thank you. No, I found it fascinating to me, yeah. But I didn't think that, Mary, that you'd want to read it. You should have called me.
If I'd known you, perhaps I would have. No, but seriously, with an honor like that, what does that do for an author's work?
Well, I have felt so outside of the literary world because I turned 50 this year. I'm not a kid. I only have two books under my belt, and it really has changed my life. It has absolutely changed my life because people take me seriously in a way, and my struggle becomes more validated. But I didn't expect it. And as a matter of fact, I think if you are a writer and you're expecting that kind of stuff, you're insane. It's not going to happen. The thing that really changed in terms of publishing, though, of this story was when it became the New York Times top 10 last year. All of a sudden, it became kind of global news, and then all of a sudden, things really started to change. And I was so surprised. I am still really surprised.
Well, what has been the reaction in Korea?
Well, it's published. It just came out, I think, like this week.
We're talking South Korea, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's gotten really nice reviews, so I'm very grateful. But South Koreans don't read many novels anymore. So that should be interesting to see how this takes. It comes out in two volumes because when you translate an American novel, it becomes much longer. So we'll see how it is.
Your words here, and I'm guessing you're referring to people in general, again in another interview, were so willing to dehumanize entire populations in order for us to conveniently go along with our lives. We know exactly one North Korean, for example, and of course that's Kim Jong-un, I'm assuming you're mm-hmm. referring mm-hmm. to. So how do we view North Koreans? What should we make of this country?
There are 25 million people who live in this nation that's only 70 years old. And there are basically about two generations of those who have been captive, and they cannot travel even to the next town. They don't have the most basic human rights. And we keep forgetting about that. We keep focusing on this one person who is a grandson of another dictator. So I think that when we forget about the lives of 25 million people who don't have the most basic human rights, it's really a travesty on our part as modern people with consciences. So one of the things I'm constantly trying to say is, as long as I have breath in my body, is they're human beings just like us. And we keep focusing on one person. So there is no regime. There's no regime. Like, there are people that Kim Jong-un can kill at any second. He has killed already several people who are at the very, very, very top. So when you say, oh, that person might be his right-hand person, it's like, no, that person's also terrified.
Yeah. What did you think of the Olympics in which North Korean and South Korean athletes marched under one flag?
I was really moved by it because my father's from the north area of Korea and my mother's from the south. So I thought it was quite beautiful. However, I'm very cognizant of the fact that modern South Korean young people have no interest in reunification. So I'm very respectful because they are the ones who are going to bear the brunt of such a cost. Yeah. But the overwhelming majority of young people, and I mean people under 40, have no interest in reunification.
What was the conversation like in your household with parents from two different parts of the peninsula?
Oh, well, you know, it only comes up in very simple things like food, because things are differently made depending upon where you live.
And the sense I got from Pachinko is that food was such an extraordinary part of the culture. It's
oh,
a
yeah.
point of pride for a Korean woman to be able to cook well. And there's a whole scene in the book about that. But anyway, go ahead.
When you're poor, and Korea has been a poor country for such a long time, it's a 5,000-year civilization. However, it's the majority of the people were agrarians, which means that they're peasants or farmers, and they have nothing. So food becomes really important in terms of how do you make something taste good when you don't have very much at all. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the cuisine of France, it's very similar. They made really delicious things out of things that shouldn't taste very good. If you think about it, like, they eat frogs. Okay. Snails. And it's delicious.
When you think about it that way.
Right.
And just one more, you know, question along political lines. So do you think a possible summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, do you hold out hope that, you know, if this does materialize, that ground might be gained?
Yes. Yes, because I am perennially an optimistic person. I think engagement is always better. Engagement is always better. Even if we make mistakes, it's always better than to not have engagement. Am I naive about their intentions? No, of course not. None of us are naive about their intentions. But I do think we have to start engagement, even if for the next administration, for which I hold out hope too.
So back to where this novel has been published. Has it been published in Japan?
It has not. It's been sold to 23 countries, but not to Japan.
Tell us, Minjin Lee, about wisdom and the role it plays in what you read and write.
Oh, it's the thing that I care about most. And as I get older, the only thing I really care about is wisdom. Like, how do you live a wise life? How do you make wise choices? What makes a wise parent? Like, I'm a parent, and I think, gosh, like, I have messed up so many times. And
if someone Most of us do.
Yes. But we make these mistakes, and I think, oh, golly, like, if I could have just known better. So it's not that I'm interested in parent literature or literature about, like, doing anything differently necessarily, but I have gleaned wisdom from places that I did not expect. Very often in interviews, I learn a great deal about how people made certain choices and how they've made their mistakes. Mm. And then you can also glean wisdom from it. So that's my quest. I mean, I do a weird job. I make books and I want people to read these books. And I think that the books that I love are not just entertaining, and that's very important. I think books must give pleasure to the reader. However, I'm also reading for insight. So if the author doesn't have insight, I'm not that interested because I can be entertained doing many things. So it's got to be both those things. So that means that my job is to go out and get insight and also be entertaining and then put it together.
And the impression I've gotten in terms of trying to attain wisdom is that you really need to take time to think and contemplate. And it's a crazy rushed world. And you have found this time? Make this time?
I think I have to constantly pull back and think about what happened. Because when I'm in it, I want to be responsive and thoughtful and good. However, when you pull back from a scene or a situation in your life and you think about what you did and how it should have been, that takes active dissent against popular culture. I have to constantly dissent against popular culture because popular culture's messages of being busy and distracted is so commonplace.
And you've also said that you think today's fascination with youth is, quote, bananas.
It's absolutely bananas, and it makes no sense at all because if you're lucky, you get to age.
If you're lucky, you get to age.
If you're lucky, right?
Yeah. So one more quick question for you. Novel number three, Free Food. No, that was the first one. Novel number three, I'll get this out, is under construction. When can we expect it? And again, the title.
Oh, the title is American Hagwon, and I hope to have it out in a few years.
All right, Minjin Lee, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us for
Thank
Radio
you,
Times.
Mary.
Minjin Lee is author of the novel Pachinko. And as always, don't forget to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. You'll find everything at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.